morning, everyone. I thought I'd introduce this presentation by reading for you, it's rather long, it's a page and a half. Daniel O'Leary, who died recently, you may have heard of him. It's a book called An Astonishing Secret, published in Ireland in 2017, and then last year here in Australia. And I'm reading the foreword to set the tone for this presentation. Once we equate God with life itself, a transformation takes place in the way we believe. Once we remove everything that separates divinity from humanity, heaven and earth, grace and nature, then we begin to truly and freely live and move in another milieu. Once we use the same name for the gracious mystery and mother of all becoming, and the primal energy of creation and ongoing evolution, our faith cannot ever be the same again. And once we commit to identifying God's intimate presence in our evolving sensual perception of the world's most beautiful artistry, creativity and imagination, in our every breath and heartbeat, in our daily darkness and invisible light, then we are living the incarnation of God in Jesus. And we are then also adoring the only adorable reality, the mystery of being itself. It signals the death of a God out there and the birth of the God at the burning heart of creation itself and at the core of your own being. If God could have revealed God's self without the world, wrote Meister Eckhart, God would not have created it. This is the revelation of an astonishing secret. It's a new moment of grace. It's like an earthquake in your heart, and you are afraid no more. When this Catholic sacramental faith imagination becomes second nature to you, a profound simplicity envelops your soul. What is this sacramental vision? When you learn to really look at what's before you, the delight and pain that's around you, when you feel something of the hidden joy and despair of others, their desire for life and their cold despair, it's then also and only then that you reach the place of intimacy with the divine incarnate God. Jesus added nothing extra to the initial creation. The Father had not forgotten anything. What was added when the time was right was the new and the love and meaning in it all. What Jesus introduced and accomplished by his death and resurrection was not a legal contract of atonement with his demanding Father. It was the depth and invincibility of love. Love transforms darkness, death, and sin. It's the very energy of creation, of evolution. Jesus, the human one, love personified, brought a new understanding of our world and our lives, a different way of seeing everything through the lens of an unconditional love. When everything we see, touch, hear, and smell is perceived as the embrace of the divine arms, when the winter chill, the city noises, the brilliance of artists, and the revelations of scientists provide glimpses of an incarnate God, when the new universe story captures our hearts with a profound and transforming wonder, when the courage and hope of oppressed people on a mutilated earth are experienced as the empowering presence of the Holy Spirit within, then, and only then, are we living within the incarnation. To do this faithfully, we need a sacramental community of love around us. And it concludes with the prayer for the 17th Sunday of Ordinary Time. And it notes in the old translation. And it reads, let us pray. Pray for the faith to recognize God's presence in our world. O God, our Father, open our eyes to see you at work in the splendor of creation, in the beauty of human life. Touched by your hand, our world is holy. Help us to cherish the gifts that surround us, to share your blessings with our brothers and sisters, and to experience the joy of life in your presence. So I've chosen to share with you this morning a very limited text. It's in front of you. It's from St. Paul's letter to the Colossians. It's a hymn, perhaps composed by Paul, and in any case quoted by him and then reflected on by him in this letter. It's probable that Paul wrote from Ephesus. You can see by the map, it's not that far to Colossae, though he himself hadn't visited it. One of his disciples did during the 3 years that Paul was in Ephesus. I'll read the text, and then I'm going to spend time meditating on it for you. The hymn, and it is a hymn, breaks into two stanzas. The first is about God's beloved Son and creation. Before I begin it, we just have to realize that the language we're using of Jesus is necessarily poetic. It's necessarily analogy. We don't see God, we can't describe God, but we have images that help us point towards the mystery rather than fail around it, but actually to point towards. So when we call Jesus God's Son, we're not talking about some miraculous way in which God substituted for Joseph. That's not the son we're talking about. It's not a biological statement about God and some miraculous intervention. It's because we're all sons and daughters of God, aren't we? Jesus is the Son because he, amazingly and beautifully and heroically, saw God as the source of his life and never, but never, spoke or acted or lived except from that intimacy he had with God, whom he called Abba. That's the shock of Jesus and the beauty of Jesus. So he shows us that God is the nurturer and the source of everything. And in his first stanza, this is about Jesus, God's beloved Son, and creation. And it reads, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him were created all things, in heaven and on earth, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers," all words used by the people in Colossae about the stars and the gods of the heavens and so on, all of that. "All things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together." And you can see why we need to unpack that. The second stanza is about Jesus, the beloved Son, and redemption. So we're not only created, but we need to be freed, because unfortunately, it didn't happen in Jesus' case because of his heroic love, but for us, we can get trapped, and our Egypts, we can be slaves, we can be enslaved to a whole lot of things, by what we inherit and by what we do and by what's around us and by the culture we live in. So we need redeeming, we need liberating in order to live as sons and daughters of God. So the second stanza is about this redemption. "He is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, he's the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For God was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in him. And through him, God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things by making peace through the blood of his cross." So some introductory remarks that are pretty obvious, but I'll make them if I may. Being a hymn, this passage is to be received as one receives poetry. We're not to look for the kind of precision that satisfies the logical mind. It's the language of the heart, which aims to lift us to insights that the inquiring mind cannot fathom. If the poetry is good, the richness of evocative suggestion more than compensates for the lack of logical definition. The Hebrew scriptures constantly speak of God as creator and redeemer. This hymn stands in that tradition, except that the focus here is on God's beloved Son. Through reflection on the unique intimacy that exists between Jesus and God, Christians came to think of the one and only God. We're monotheists, as you know. They came to think of this one and only God not as existing in isolated individuality, but as one God because of perfect love communion. While retaining strict monotheism and while upholding the obvious truth of the distinction between Jesus and the God whom he addressed as my Father. When Jesus spoke about God, he wasn't talking about himself. When Jesus prayed to God, he wasn't praying to himself, clearly. They could no longer, this is in the early church, because of the experience we're going to talk about this morning, they couldn't use the word God anymore. Because the whole world is talking about God at that time, and still, I guess. But the images of God are just, well, hopeless, really. When they used the word God, they made sure we kept Jesus as the focus of our attention, so that we'd see God and not the God of our imagination or transference or projections or whatever. They couldn't use the word God without including Jesus, whose words, whose actions, whose face, and whose heart revealed the true God to Jesus' disciples, and hopefully to us. It is this insight that finds expression in this hymn, which contrasts God's beloved Son with all created things and states that he is before all things. This hymn speaks of Jesus as the manifestation in time of a Son who is eternal and not created. The hymn is an early example of what Pliny, the governor of Bithynia Pontus, that's just under the Black Sea, he wrote in 112 AD to the Emperor Trajan, and in the letter he says, he talks about Christians as singing hymns to Christ as to a God. Well, you can't blame a pagan, legate, I'll call him, because the word won't come to me. You can't blame him for thinking in their worship of Jesus, they were worshipping Jesus as a God. No, they weren't. They were looking at Jesus and with him worshipping God. We are all the richer for the penetrating insights that have come from the contemplation of Christian theologians whose love and prayer has taken them beyond the paths that we're accustomed to walk. I think of Karl Rahner and plenty of others, gifts that we've been given. Daniel O'Leary. While we learn from them, the theologians, and are grateful for the grace to share their faith and their insights, theological reflection on the divinity of Christ is perhaps best pursued by theologians who are mystics. It seems to me that the hymn can be appreciated at a level which, if not as profound as that just mentioned, nevertheless draws us close to the heart of Jesus, God's beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. So I'll leave the peaks of that mystical theology to you for your own contemplation, but I'll attempt here to describe the lower depths of the mountain. It's a hymn about Jesus, God's beloved Son, of whom Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians, not long after this letter was written, when the fullness of time had come, God sent his Son, born of a woman. Sorry, that's Galatians. It's a hymn about Jesus, the image of God, through whom God brought about a new creation. Paul again, if anyone is in Christ, there's a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, Everything has become new. It's a hymn about Jesus, through whom God revealed his redeeming love to the whole world. When Jesus gave himself in love, even to pouring out his life's blood on the cross. The crucifying of Jesus is a symbol of the worst human behaviour, murdering innocents, and for other reasons I won't go into. So that's a dreadful thing, of course. But if we look at Jesus, the one we've pierced, all we see is love, and it's the love that reveals God, not the crucifying, of course. Through Jesus, God chose to draw to himself the whole of creation and all people, reconciling us to himself. I'm quoting Paul throughout here to show you how the letter, the hymn is so consistent with Paul's teaching. If while we were enemies we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son, much more surely we have been reconciled, having been reconciled, will we be saved, healed, given life by his life. This is a hymn about the risen, exalted and glorified Jesus, the first fruits of all who have died. It celebrates the new creation, the final great eschatological event in which God grants the gift of his life-giving Spirit in its fullness. Paul wants the Colossians to know that the full outpouring of God's grace is not to be found in strange, occult, pagan cults with their esoteric taboos and rituals. God's loving action is for the liberation of all and is to be found in Jesus and in the communion of love that is found in the Christian church. As he writes to the Romans, the whole creation has been groaning in labour pains until now. It will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. The labour pains reached their climax in the death of Jesus on the cross and found their resolution when God embraced his beloved Son and raised him to life. Sin has lost its power to deceive. Death has given way to life. This is what God is offering to the whole human race and to the whole of the created universe. It's now possible for peace to reign everywhere. There's no need to fear death. There's no need to fear the effects of sin. There's no need to live in fear of the mysterious cosmic powers that are said to hold sway over people's minds and hearts. And we must include there the myriad false images of God. Everything that is true, that is, everything that's real, is offered to us in Jesus and can be enjoyed in a divine communion of love that comes through faith in him. So now let's look at the hymn. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. In him were created all things. in heaven and earth, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. This first stanza makes two basic assertions about God's beloved Son. The first is, he's the image of the icon is the Greek word, the image of the invisible God. And the second is, he's the firstborn of all creation. The rest of the stanza draws out the implications of these two affirmations. Greek philosophers spoke of the cosmos, and especially of mankind, as being in the image of the unseen God. You can read that in the Stoics of the time. The Genesis account of creation tells us that God created humankind in his own image. By contrast, the focus of our hymn is on Jesus, and not on his being the image of God along with creation or with humankind. There's a place for that, but that's not the focus of this hymn. Jesus stands out in contrast with the whole of the cosmos, with special accent on the invisible angelic world. He's the image of God, and everything is created, now we have to go through this carefully, everything's created in him, through him, and for him. He's the one, as the hymn says, who holds all things together. If we want to find what Paul was meditating on to enable him, assuming he's the author, to compose this hymn, we find literature that points in the direction of our hymn by looking not at the philosophers, the Stoics, whom Paul studied under in Tarsus, or the book of Genesis, which he knew well as a Jewish Pharisee, but rather on the personification of wisdom, as, for example, and I'll quote a few texts for you, and you'll see the echo, the music coming from here. The book of Wisdom writes, "Wisdom is a breath of the power of God, a pure emanation of the glory of the Almighty. She is a reflection of eternal light, a spotless mirror of the working of God, an image of God's goodness." That's from Wisdom chapter 7, or Proverbs chapter 8. "The Lord created me," Wisdom is talking, "the Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of long ago. Ages ago, I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth. Then I was beside God, like a master worker, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him in his presence always." Sirach, Ecclesiasticus, you might be used to calling it. Wisdom was created before all other things, and prudent understanding from eternity. Before the ages in the beginning, he created me, Wisdom, and for all the ages I shall not cease to be. In the book of Wisdom again, "With you is wisdom. She who knows your works and was present when you made the world. Proverbs again. The Lord by wisdom founded the earth, by understanding he established the heavens. And finally, back to wisdom. If riches are a desirable possession in life, what is richer than wisdom? The active cause of all things. And if understanding is effective, who more than she is fashioner of what exists? I've done all that hoping, and maybe with further reflection, hoping that you can see the language of the hymn in that. Jesus being presented artistically, poetically, as wisdom made flesh, of course, as word made flesh. The hymn goes on to draw out the implications of the unique position of the risen Jesus. All things were created in him. In him, says the hymn, all things hold together. Just as wisdom was poured out on all God's works, and just as by his word all things hold together, so the life and glory of the exalted Jesus is poured out through his Spirit, renewing creation. His Spirit fills all creation and binds everything together. It is here that the hymn echoes Stoic imagery. They thought of the divine as a living fire, imminent in the cosmos, and they identified the divine with nature, for which, through which, and in which everything exists. While the conceptual content of the hymn is different from this, the language is similar. In saying that all things were created for him, which the hymn does, the hymn is pointing to Jesus as the goal. It's all for him, it's all in view of him. The goal of creation, the one towards whom everything is directed, including all of us, of course. In saying that all things were created through him, through Jesus, it's speaking of his mediatory role. As Paul wrote elsewhere in his first letter to the Corinthians, for us there's one God, the Father. And that word is taken, of course, from Jesus' prayer and revelation. For us there's one God, the Father, from whom are all things, God, and for whom we exist. And there's one Lord, Jesus the Messiah, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. The language of the hymn is the language of the heart. It resists the limits imposed by prose definitions. We could suggest that one aspect of the mediatory role in creation is that of the exalted Jesus existing in the mind of God as the one in whom creation would reach its perfection. So God willing this creature, willing Jesus, willing someone, willing to be the perfect receptor of everything, then everything is evolving towards him. And it's looking at him, as it were, like an architect, looking at the plans, looking at him. God said, let there be light, let there be, let there be, let there be, and the whole of the evolving universe is actually in view of through this Jesus. As an architect's plan exists before the building is begun, so the exalted Jesus can be said to be before all things. I grew up with the mythical language, nothing wrong with it, except as with all mythical language, if you take it literally, you're hopelessly out of your depth. I grew up with a mythical language somehow. Well, I think Jesus was in heaven, then God sent him down to earth. And then he was incarnate into the womb of Mary. Well, Jesus did. That's not the way it works. Jesus' life began at his conception. Chronologically, he didn't exist before John the Baptist, of course, or his mother, or Joseph, or Elizabeth. The before in this context, before all things, speaks of an ontological priority rather than a temporal one. For there's no time in God, and to introduce temporal imagery into the divine can lead only to confusion. And by the way, we're doing it all the time, if we're not, because we can't but do it. Our mind is hardwired to think of everything in space and time. So we put God in space and time, and we put Jesus after the resurrection in space and time, and we think of ourselves dying and then waiting for the end of the world. You know what I'm saying, don't you? This is this kind of language. We can't but imagine it in any other way, because that's the way we imagine everything. But we've got an intelligence, and the intelligence is supposed to come in and say, hang on, that's the way you're imagining, but it's not like that. There's no time in God. If Jesus was before all things, that's not temporal before, it's God's purpose, God's longing, God's willing to create, and the perfect creation is Jesus. The Stoics thought of the whole cosmos as the body. The religion that was in danger of seducing the Christians at Colossae, and I can't go into this with you now, seems to have thought of super-terrestrial spirits as the head of the body, powerfully coordinating and organizing the cosmos. They also thought that the fullness, which is the divinity, could permeate humans only if they experienced visions and shared in the worship offered to God by the angels. To achieve this perfection, we must follow, they said, certain practices. Against all such thinking, the hymn fixes our eyes on Jesus. Whatever powers, whether terrestrial or super-terrestrial, exercise influence over our lives, they're all subject to him. As the second stanza goes on to affirm, it's through our communion in the love which he is offering in the community of the church that we experience the fullness of divine life and the peace that comes with divine communion. So let's look at the second stanza. He, this is Jesus, who lived with us, died a dreadful death, but died beautifully that death, and was embraced by God, and the experiences which we could have looked at, and you'll be looking at it all over Easter, these experiences have to be treated with great imagination and poetry and music and art, and not nailed to the floor in logical precision. Well, those experiences of Mary of Magdala being called Mary, called by name, you've all been called by name, but we can not notice the call. disciples walking away from truth, broken, lost, confused, disappointed. But then through studying the scriptures, through the Eucharist, they came to a deeper insight into the presence of this risen one among them. He said, I'll be with you always. And they knew it. They experienced it. They felt it. It was real for them and life-changing. And I won't go through the rest, that'd be silly. But all Easter you're going to be looking at all that. He's the head of the body of the church. He's the head, not some angelic whatever. He's the beginning. He's the firstborn from the dead. How full of promise is that? So that he might come to have first place in everything. Jesus didn't want first place in everything. We're not talking about what he wanted. He wanted the first place from his Father. I must become less and less. He must become more and more. He wanted us to be in touch with God in the depths of our own being, where the spring of living water will well up. He didn't want to create dependence or all of that. That's what Jesus wanted, surely. But the church wants us to stop pointing in all these million directions out of our fears and our whatever, focusing on this amazing Jesus. Because only that way will we be free to see God. God was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in Jesus. As a baby, as a child, as a beautiful teenager, as a young man in his ministry, God was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in him. Brackets. And the whole point of Paul's letter is he wants all the fullness to be in you and in me and in us. In fact, in the whole of creation. That's the mission. Through him, God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether in earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross. After singing of the unique role of Jesus in creation, we're invited now to sing of his role in the community of love in which the new creation is being realized. This is not the first time that the church has been called a body. It is, however, the first time that Jesus, by Paul, and the letters, of course, are the earliest works of the New Testament, it's the first time that Jesus has been described as the head. In earlier texts of Paul's letters, the focus was on our communion with Christ as members of his body, and on our consequent communion with each other. Corinthians, the bread that we break, is it not a sharing in the body of the Messiah? Because there's one bread, we who are many are one body. We all partake of the one bread. And Paul again, Corinthians 12, just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with the Messiah. For in the one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, and we were all made to drink of the one Spirit. You are the body of the Messiah, and individually members of it. And to the Romans, Paul writes, as in one body with many members, not all the members have the same function, so we, who are many, are the one body in the Messiah, and individually we're members one of another. That's the language we're familiar with here, for the first time in Paul's writing, in this hymn. In keeping with the focus of the hymn, our attention stays on Jesus. It's Jesus and not other power who is the head of this body. In other words, it's he who is the source, the head of the river from which it springs from the mountainside and then flows its journey to the sea. The head of the church, the source of everything, is Jesus, the risen Christ. He alone is guiding and directing it. It's he who is the beginning, the first to be raised from the dead. From him and from him alone comes the fullness of the new life that's offered to all. The hymn reaches its most lyrical heights in verse 19, which reads, God has pleased, was pleased, for all the fullness to dwell in him. Now, from those earlier texts and from your knowledge anyhow, that's what flows into us. That's what happened at Pentecost. That's what happened at every Pentecost, every sacrament, every Eucharist. It's happening all the time. From the fullness of Christ flows the river of God's life, bringing about a new creation. At Jesus' baptism, we're told that a voice came from heaven, from God, in other words. You, now I'm sure Jesus didn't hear anything with his ears, for God's sake. This is an experience he had. He heard here. You are my son. You're the one I love. I'm well pleased with you. Brackets. Isn't it beautiful to think that that was said to you at your baptism and to me? That's what baptism is about, of course. That word spoken. Here we sing of how it pleased God to raise Jesus from the dead into his eternal embrace, to fill him with divine glory, and through him to pour out the fullness of this glory, the fullness of loving communion upon the church, and through the church to the whole world. It's by living in him, by belonging to his body, the church, not to some esoteric cult, that we participate in the fullness of divinity which Jesus embodies. The saints came to see this. We're all called to be saints. So we open our eyes of our heart and our mind to the wonder of this extraordinary mystery. For those, writes Paul to the Romans, whom God foreknew, he also predestined. Foreknew and predestined are, of course, temporal terms. Paul knows they're totally inadequate, but they're the only words we can use because we think in time. For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son. Why? In order that he might be the firstborn within a large family. And those whom he predestined, he called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified. And our hymn insists, as of the Old Testament, this is not God selecting some, it's for all uniquely to come into the fullness, the whole of creation. The first stanza was all embracing. I'll quote from it again. We sang of all creation. And the expression all things occurs three times in those verses. Now, as the hymn reaches its climax, we dare to sing that God was pleased through him to reconcile to himself all things. In one of Paul's most beautiful statements in 2 Corinthians, he wrote, all of us, with unveiled faces, got nothing to hide, and the veil of the temple was torn asunder at the crucifixion. So we can see the face of God in the face of Jesus. So all of us with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as reflected in a mirror. Jesus is the mirror, the image. We are all being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, the Spirit. For it is God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God. Where? In the face of Jesus. Contemplating the fullness of God's radiant glory on the face of Jesus, we're astonished at God's love and what it pleases God to do in creation through the mediation of his beloved Son. How can anyone resist such love? How can anyone seek fulfillment in any other way? We dare to hope that this broken, sin-prone world will be reconciled to God. We dare to express in song our hope that everyone, indeed the whole universe, will know the peace that comes only from communion with God in him, in Jesus. It's a Christian hymn, grounded in the real world and grounded in the real history of Jesus of Nazareth. Paul chooses to quote it because it beautifully expresses his central insights. It's typical of Paul that it comes to its conclusion in a contemplation of the self-giving, love-giving, life-giving act of Jesus on Calvary. It's in contemplating Jesus on the cross that we see the glory of God revealed. It's in love, the love poured out there, that we see what it means to be created in God's image. And it's from the pierced heart of Jesus on the cross that the church is born and that God's love radiates out for the healing and life of the world. And we're privileged to be part of that mission. I'll just conclude by reading the hymn again and then we'll have a piece of music. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. In him were created all things, in heaven and on earth, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, in him all things hold together. He's the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For God was pleased for all the fullness to dwell in him. And through him, God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace